Coming up, the Vatican makes it easier for Anglicans to become Catholics. Also, doctors who pray with their patients.
We come before your throne today, Lord.
And Mary Setterholm, abused as a child and a former prostitute, but now saving the lives of other women.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The Vatican announced plans to make it easier for disaffected Anglicans to convert to Catholicism. Cardinal William Levada, head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, said new structures will be created to accommodate growing numbers of Anglicans who want to leave the worldwide Anglican Communion because of disputes over homosexuality and female clergy. Under the new plan, those Anglicans can become Catholics while still maintaining some of their distinctive beliefs and practices, including the tradition of married priests. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, is here, and so from Denver is John Allen, longtime Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. Welcome to you both. John, what's the Vatican up to here? Is it fishing for converts?
Well, officially, Bob, the answer to that question is no. I mean, some Anglicans may see it that way, but the Vatican's position is we didn't go looking for these folks. They came to us. That is, there is a small but significant number of more traditionalist Anglicans who very publicly have asked to be received into the Catholic Church. And the Vatican's line is that even though we didn't solicit them, when people knock on our door, we have a responsibility to open it up.
And Kim, what do you hear? Reaction from the Anglicans?
Well, officially, the spiritual head of the 77 million member Anglican Communion, Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has been, you know, somewhat positive about this. He says he does not see it as an act of aggression from the Catholic Church, but certainly his church body has been under enormous pressure from a lot of fronts, and this is one more front, one more sort of exit possibility for many Anglicans who are unhappy with what's been going on in their church.
What do you both think, John, first? What do you think about the numbers that will be involved here? Will it be a lot of people that are switching or just a few?
Well, the signals from the Catholic side, at least, is that expectations are this is going to be a fairly small number of folks. When Cardinal Levada was asked this question at a Vatican briefing earlier in the week, he said that there were 20 or 30 Anglican bishops in various parts of the world who had put out feelers. But, of course, putting out feelers is different than signing on the bottom line. And at the grassroots, the expectation is that at least in the early stages, you're talking about fairly small pockets of people who will be coming over.
And especially, well, here in the United States, the people who are unhappy with the Episcopal Church, which is the U.S. branch of the Anglican Communion, they come from two different wings of the church. One certainly are those who are more Catholic in their traditions and their style of worship, but there are also evangelicals who are conservative theologically, but not so comfortable with the idea of Rome and the Pope. And those two groups here in the U.S. have come together. They've formed their own structure, the Anglican Church of North America, and they're really focusing on building that. So I think a lot of the traditionalist Anglicans here in the U.S. may not immediately head to the Catholic Church.
But is there a possibility that out of this, Kim, out of this will come a more conservative, a conservative Catholic Church and a more liberal Anglican Communion?
Well, of course, if a lot of conservatives leave the Anglican Communion, it will become more liberal overall. But another scenario is that it puts more pressure on the worldwide Anglican Communion to itself become more conservative so it doesn't lose more members.
Huh. John, what about this, the effect on the Catholic Church of having more Anglicans in it, and especially with regard to married priests? I mean, is it a step, inevitably, toward a change in that position? If you let in a lot of married Anglicans, don't you then have to change your position about existing Catholic priests?
Well, that's certainly an argument some people are going to make. I mean, what we know for right now is the Vatican has clearly said that current Anglican ministers who become Catholics and become ordained as Catholic priests, if they're currently married, can remain married. The Vatican has also clearly ruled out married bishops. But what the policy is going to be going forward, we don't know. I mean, we should say that while the Vatican has made this announcement, they haven't yet given us the legal document that provides all the fine points. And this is certainly one of those fine points people will have their eyeballs on. What Vatican officials are saying on background is that whatever happens, they want to make sure that this doesn't become a loophole that in the short term erodes the broader discipline of priestly celibacy in the Catholic Church.
And John and Kim, very quickly, Kim first, what do you see as any larger effects, very quickly?
Well, certainly Christianity is realigning in many ways around the world, and you're finding people grouping together in new and different ways than they had in the past.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you see?
Well, I think in many ways ideology has replaced theology as the thing that drives Christian behavior at the grassroots. I mean, in the old days, it was debates over things like the authority of the Pope versus the Bible. These days, it tends to be where do you stand on the culture wars, and in that, in many ways, it's what's in play here.
Mm-hmm. Although a lot of the traditionalists would say those are theological issues, too.
Yeah. Kim Lawton, John Allen, many thanks. In other news, a new report says many more Americans are living in poverty than previously thought. The National Academy of Sciences said that last year, more than 47 million Americans, nearly one in six, were living in poverty. That's 7 million more than the Census Bureau figure. The report's researchers used a different formula, one that factored in where people live and their cost of living. In Washington, religious leaders gathered outside the Capitol to call for health care reform. Several held an interfaith service to remember Americans who died because they lacked health insurance. The pastors told stories of people who could not afford necessary care. And they prayed, expressing sorrow for the country's failure to, quote, care for every member of the human family. Around the country, more doctors say they are becoming comfortable praying with their patients, if the patients want it. They say they're careful not to force prayer on anyone, but many of them also say prayer seems to benefit their patients, their families, and the doctors themselves. Bob Fall reports from Memphis.
At Le Bonheur Children's Medical Center in Memphis, Tennessee, four-year-old Ethan Barker might seem carefree.
He almost took off.
But his parents, Chris and Tamara, are frightened about Ethan's upcoming brain surgery. So when neurosurgeon Dr. Stephanie Einhaus asked if the family would like to pray, they readily agree.
We come before your throne today, Lord, asking for your blessing on this sweet child of yours.
Ethan's surgery is delicate. Einhaus takes a bone from his skull and modifies it to cover a space created by an earlier surgery.
The bone of the skull is kind of in two layers, and so you can split it like an Oreo cookie.
For this skilled practitioner, praying benefits her as much as the patient's family.
If I'm having a hard time doing something, getting a catheter in a fluid space, I'll just pause, and in my own head, I will pray, please, Lord, help me get this right.
Einhaus says praying with families helps them with stress and gives them hope.
It helps them to hold on to something to get through, you know, that crisis that's going on. Most people want to do it. They're like, they're so relieved.
Oh, that was good.
11-year-old Holly Barkley, about to undergo surgery to drain fluid from her brain, does not face a crisis.
How's your head feeling?
But her family also
wants
to pray.
I pray that you'll let this family feel your power. Let them feel your peace, Lord.
Prayers like that, family members agree, can bring comfort.
It puts a sense of comfort in you that, you know, normally doctors don't do that. And it probably makes more people feel closer to the doctor. You want them to care just as much as you do.
It was more of the Lord was on our side. And it told me then it was going to be okay. You know, and I was ready to, if anything did come out, negative. I was ready to face it.
Hello. We're all done. And it went great.
Einhouse, raised Catholic and now a Southern Baptist, was once reluctant to pray with patients for fear of being ridiculed. But as time went on, she felt more comfortable asking patients if they would like to pray.
Once you start doing it, you realize how much people really like doing it and how powerful it can be as a support for not only the patient, but for the families.
You regard your role as a physician as a kind of ministry.
I do. I absolutely do.
In this part of the Bible Belt, many patients, like Marletta Scott, facing difficult triple bypass heart surgery at Methodist South Hospital, say they would welcome a chance to pray with their doctor, even though Marletta Scott's doctor, heart surgeon Alim Kandakar, happens to be Muslim.
He did explain to me that overall that, you know, it was in the Lord's hands and that he'd be watching over him as well as me during this procedure. I mean, and that's all that we can ask for.
That makes you feel good. That gives you comfort.
It does.
In his 32 years of professional experience, Kandakar says he has found that patients with faith often recover faster.
Because they rely not only on the doctors, the medicine, but they rely on a power that is more powerful than all of that. That puts them at ease with themselves, at ease with the decision they are making.
What all this suggests, especially in this part of the country, is a growing trend by physicians to treat physical and spiritual problems together. After all, says the founder of this Memphis clinic, 50% of the patients who come here for primary care do not have medical problems.
Many of our physical complaints come about because of our spirits being broken. What they need is a way for us to help them deal with this spiritual devastation.
So here at the Church Health Center, which since 1987 has treated 60,000 low-income people without health insurance, the spiritual needs of the patient are addressed before they ever see a doctor.
From my point of view, if we want to be healthier, you must have a healthy spirit as well as a healthy body. We know, I think in our heart of hearts, that being at peace, being bathed in what a person perceives as the love of God, makes people healthier faster.
But mixing prayer with medicine can cause problems, especially when the goal of reducing suffering conflicts with the wishes of devout patients. For example, a recent AMA study found that patients of faith demand and get more aggressive treatment than is medically warranted. And there are also concerns that a patient can be exploited if a doctor uses prayer to proselytize, to promote certain beliefs.
It might take the form of a particular kind of prayer that the patient might be uncomfortable with. It might include accepting certain kinds of creedal statements that the patient would not otherwise accept.
At Rhodes College, where he teaches comparative religion, Mark Musi also worries that praying with a patient could compromise a doctor's relationship with a patient.
There could be a boundary crossed there that a doctor begins to lose his objectivity in relationship to a patient. You're losing some of the critical distance, I think, that's oftentimes necessary for proper medical treatment.
Physicians like Einhouse counter that even if that boundary is crossed, no harm need result.
No matter what, you're going to develop a relationship with your patients, okay? So the fact that I'm praying with them may make that bond a little stronger, but in no way would it affect my judgment.
All right, you take care.
And that element of compassion, physicians argue, is what is often missing in the training many doctors receive.
During my training, being a cardiac surgeon, I don't think that part has been stressed enough. It helps me to have another power behind me to do what I do. I do not think enough doctors use this power.
Here, though, that recognition that the spiritual can affect the physical seems to be growing.
In the past, doctors would take care of the body and the ministers and the chaplains would take care of the soul, but now we're seeing that those two things cannot be separated.
Shortly after his surgery, Ethan was almost as playful as before. Holly, too, was doing just fine. For each, medical technology prevailed. But in this medical theater, more and more physicians seem to be sharing a belief that there is more at work here than science and skill.
We're not always in control. God's always in control. And so things may not turn out the way we want them to. We may not like it. We may not understand it, this side of eternity. But we have to trust that he is still in control. And that if they go and they die, that heaven is a really a good place.
Here, where there is recognition that when it comes to healing, fixing the body alone is an incomplete, indeed flawed, approach. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faw in Memphis, Tennessee.
We have a Lucky Severson story today about a woman in California who suffered almost unimaginable abuse as a child. Mary Setterholm became a homeless prostitute, but somehow she also became a surfing champion, a Christian, and a counselor to other women in need.
The middle-aged woman struggling with a weak surf has quite a story to tell, one of heartbreak and despair, and then a remarkable transformation. Her name is Mary Setterholm.
You know, I didn't know that what I was going through was hell. But it was hell.
There were the beatings, the sexual abuse, the prostitution. She lost her faith in humanity and God.
Good, and then step forward, yes.
In 1972, when Mary was 17, she was the U.S. Woman's National Surfing Champion. Now she owns and operates the Surf Academy in Santa Monica, where she and 80 full-time staffers teach hundreds of kids each year how to ride the waves. Some classes for kids from the inner city she offers for free. Sister Sheila McNiff of the Los Angeles Diocese met Mary in 2002.
What was your first impression?
Amazement at somebody who had such a tragic story and yet had such a heart for reaching out to other people who were suffering. And that was clear right from the beginning.
Mary's dad left home when she was a baby, ended up in jail. Her mom, working and getting a law degree, would leave Mary and her five brothers and sisters with a babysitter.
This woman would put us in a backyard dog pen area and just leave us there.
The babysitter beat the kids, and then her son and his friends gang-raped Mary several times.
I would really, really, really fight back sometimes. And I never won. Not once. But I fought. I fought. I never let them just have me.
She went to a Catholic school, was admittedly a hellraiser, and says she paid for it with violent thrashings from the nun who was her teacher. She remembers one beating in particular when she was 12.
I fainted in this beating. I mean, she's just, my head was like a melon, just banging against the wall. And so I look at the cross. There was a big cross, a horrible bloody cross of Christ up on the wall. And I remember looking at that cross and going, save me. I really experienced like a talking back from the cross. And it was, yes, this is what you go through. No one comes for you. And when I heard those words, I fainted. Not because of the beating, but because of what I heard, a truth about the cross.
And then she was sexually abused by a now deceased priest.
You know, they come out with their big robes and everyone goes and hugs the father. But he would take me off to the side and he would get busy right away fondling me.
The ocean became her sanctuary, has been ever since she was 6 years old. As a teenager, she started hitchhiking to the beach, and that's when she turned her first trick.
I kind of fell into it, which is how it happens for most women. They don't really have a cognitive thought, I'm going to prostitute.
She wasn't much older than some of the kids she coaches when she started turning tricks regularly. Says taking money for sex gave her a feeling of control in a world where she had so little. But she's convinced she almost lost control, almost lost her life, to one man who picked her up.
I said, hey, I wanted to go to Newport. I thought you're going to Newport. And he just backhanded me. He just started beating me. While he's doing that, I look at the car door. I want to just jump out. and it's wired shut. There was no handle. It was a death trap.
She used her surfboard as a shield and barely managed to jump out of the car. Her run of bad breaks continued after she moved to New York, married a Muslim, and had 5 kids she is still close to.
But your husband?
Yes.
He was abusive, too?
Yes, he was severe, very abusive. I've been in 2 shelters for battered women.
After her divorce, Mary returned to prostitution. She was with a John when she experienced what became a transformational moment.
I look out through a crack in these curtains, these van curtains, and I see this cross of Christ. And I just felt this stab in my heart. And I got to feel my broken heart in that moment. The broken heart of the cross itself. The broken heart of being where I was. A sense of, I don't know how to stop this. I don't know how to get out of here. I don't know how you can even get to me and find me, yet I feel you all around me.
After hearing all the stories about the Catholic Church's sexual abuse scandal, Mary decided she needed to share hers. She contacted Sister Sheila McNiff, the L.A. Diocese Victim Assistance Coordinator, told her she wasn't interested in monetary compensation. She simply wanted to help others like herself. After hearing her story, Sister McNiff asked her if she would tell it directly to Cardinal Roger Mahoney.
Right away, it was obvious to me that Mary had the capacity to steal his heart. My impression of Cardinal Mahoney is someone who is very serious, and you don't get a warm, fuzzy side of him. But Mary found that place in his heart for really speaking her truth and speaking on behalf of other victim survivors.
The Cardinal asked her to become his emissary and tell her story to other victims. She gave the Cardinal her surfing trophy, and it now reportedly sits on his desk.
We were talking, and she was saying she'd never finished college, and I was astounded. It was clearly this was an articulate woman.
So Mary went to Loyola Marymount University and got her bachelor's degree in theology. Professor Jeff Syker is chairman of the Theological Studies Department.
She speaks her own truth. She speaks from her experience. She speaks from the streets. And she's determined not to let the academic institution be a purely academic institution. If it's not going to make a difference in the world, if it's not going to be engaged in the world, then what use is it?
Now that Mary is no longer homeless herself, she searches out those who are.
She finds homeless women in bushes. She'll take them home and put them in the bathtub and put their clothes in the washing machine and take them down to a shelter. She knows the shelters. She knows the laws. She knows who to ask for help. And she's just an incredible human being with compassion.
We come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could introduce us to our authentic self.
She started a support group for women with deep emotional problems and no one to share them with. It's called Serenity Sisters. First Erica, then Donna.
I read once that 1 in 3 women is assaulted or sexually abused by the time she's 18. Where do you take that stuff? Where do you process that stuff?
And it's because of Mary's non-judgmental presence. We're all welcome. All our stories are welcome.
So the real call to me is to be present alongside a sinner. I have hope that they feel the presence of someone loving them. That is my number one objective.
The Serenity Sisters will continue to meet while Mary moves to New York long enough to earn joint master's degrees, one in divinity from the Union Theological Seminary and one in social work from Columbia. She plans to use her education and her experience to help other women and kids escape the misery that was her life. She's going to New York because she knows she can't study if she's anywhere close to the surf. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Santa Monica, California.
In New Orleans, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, the spiritual leader of the world's 275 million Orthodox Christians, began a 3-week visit to the United States. Bartholomew, who is known as a champion of environmental causes, was the keynote speaker at a conference on water issues. Before he heads home to Istanbul, the Patriarch is also expected to visit New York, Atlanta, and Washington. On our calendar this Sunday, Protestants mark Reformation Day. It commemorates Martin Luther's defiance of the Catholic Church by nailing 95 theses to a church door challenging all comers to debate. Luther's protest launched the Protestant Reformation. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website. You can comment on our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, a bagpiper from this week's interfaith service to remember those without health care at National City Christian Church in Washington.